You're listening to the Talking Forest podcast with your host, Kendra Burns. In today's world, it's important to communicate your story online, and Kendra can help you by diving into social media and providing you with free tips and insights on how to build your organic social media following and shine online. Having been raised low income, first in her family to go to college, and a proud international military spouse, Kendra develops creative media content across many social media platforms from anywhere in the world. Her inspiration comes from the people who give her hope and believe in her so she can believe in you. Follow the Talking Forest podcast today to see how she lives the dream of a traveling virtual entrepreneur and get your tech tips as we keep up with the latest on social media.
Hi, this is Kendra Burns, your host of the Talking Forest podcast. I am excited to work with Maryland Forest Association on the Faces of Forestry, and I'm going to be introducing Tony to you. He works for Pixel, and we are excited to get to know him and talk about the Faces of Forestry.
When I was young, the way I got into forestry, when I was young, say early teens, I just developed a love for the outdoors, and I grew up in Silver Spring, Maryland, so it was fairly urban area, suburban back then, but, you know, fairly urban. So I didn't grow up out in the woods, but my godfather used to take me hunting when I was young. And that's where I developed that love for the outdoors. So I knew from an early age that I wanted to go into something in the natural resource profession. At that point in my life, I couldn't have told you what the difference between a wildlife biologist, a soil conservationist, or forester was, obviously, but I knew I wanted to go into some kind of an outdoor. That love of the outdoors never changed. So when it came time to go to college, I applied to Virginia Tech and was accepted and pursued a degree in forestry. There I graduated in 1982 with a BS. My first job out of college, back in 82, at the time, we were the largest graduating class, forestry class of Virginia Tech history, I think. We were over 100. So back in those days, there were a lot of foresters coming out of school. And it was tough sometimes finding a job. So I wasn't able to find a forestry job, what I'll call, making quotation marks with my fingers, an actual forestry job when I got to school. So I went to work for the National Park Service, actually on the mall in Washington, D.C., not far from where I grew up. So it wasn't, you know, what you consider, it was National Park Service, obviously, but it wasn't what you consider forestry work. But what I learned there at the National Park Service was how to relate to the public and relate topics of interpretive work.
Yeah.
Through the National Park Service. And so that's something that I think through my career has served me well. I think probably so far removed from it now, I'm going to admit I'm probably not as good at it, not as articulate now as I was 20 years ago. But I always felt starting back then that that was a really, really important aspect to this job in any profession. So I went from the National Park Service to Carroll County, Maryland Parks and Recreation, and I was a naturalist at Piney Run Park there for about a year and doing what naturalists normally do. I was doing interpretive programs, mainly with school children, and I loved it. I loved it. Didn't pay well, but I loved it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that kind of career path is okay. And there's still people that work for the parks today. I actually worked for state parks in 2017 myself, and I hired on 800 park aides in one season. So I do kind of relate to your career path in that. And also I went to my bachelor's degree, which was more natural resources, more environmental sided. And so getting to see those pieces and piecing it all together does actually give you a well-rounded resume.
Absolutely. And again, I found doing that job, you know, before then I wouldn't have known it, but at that stage in my life, I really loved talking about forestry issues and you know, nature and you know, anything that had to do with discovering things in the outdoors. And I loved the way the kids would respond to those things, you know, opening their eyes to things that maybe they hadn't really ever been exposed to or hadn't thought about. So it was a lot of fun. But I, you know, even back then, that was in the early 80s. And, you know, I yearned for that forestry position. I wanted to go out there and literally get my hands dirty doing forestry work. So in 1986, I was hired on at the Maryland Forest Service in Allegheny County out in the western end of the state, working in my first real, again, forestry, I'll call it forestry job. And I love that. I mean, I just loved it. I was young and I going up and down those hills. Back in those days, I could go up and down those hills all day long, you know, not yeah. that down. Unfortunately, those days are past me now, but I mean, I was going up and down those. I don't know how many hundreds of acres of firewood, timber stand improvement markings I did, but it was fun. But I enjoyed it. And I spent a little over a year in Allegheny and Garrett counties working out there, and then transferred down to the Eastern Shore of Maryland in Worcester County as the project forester in Worcester County. Ended up as in charge of Worcester and Somerset County as project manager. And then I left the state in 1996. And I went to work for a private industry. And actually, kind of a big change. The state forestry work is obviously a lot of land management, working with private landowners, trying to help them achieve their objectives on their properties, switching over to the procurement industrial end is, you know, I don't think a lot of people have made that switch, but it's not normal. You know, it's not usually people working in one end of the natural resource management or the other, but I made that switch over to forest industry and started buying wood for a sawmill back in the, like I said, 1996.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And so with that, it's kind of interesting because in when I was going into the sector, since I was a female, I was having a hard time actually getting into the field. And so I did have field positions in my internships. I did the naturalist thing and I did conservation in the field. So I did all that. And then I also worked for Rainier Inc., which is a well-known forestry company. Mm-hmm. And I was having a hard time getting any offers, although I was interviewing really well and I had the resume in my mid-20s. And so it was funny that you say it's hard. It depends if you go into the private sector first or the state sector and or industry. And you're right in that because I was given the opportunity to either work for Department of Natural Resources or for the Protection Association of Forests. And that was on the table in 2015, which is 2 years out of my bachelor's degree. And I got to choose. And the reason why I chose private was because of the glass ceiling and it not having that, you know, that leveling up that you have to do in the state government where it's so rigid because I watched the salaries and the way that it worked. And I had to key all that in human resources anyway when I worked there at state parks. So it was really interesting for me to make that decision. But I picked private sector because it was more opportunity and they were able to create a position for me, which was way different than the state. And it was really nice to grow and learn and be able to, you know, fail and have someone pick me up from the department and that I was in, and they would help me and mentor me and you know, teach me about forestry in Washington State. So, right. So yeah, it can happen, you know, either way, private or state sector, but it's good that you've been able to be on both sides.
Well, I think so, because I mean, it is a pretty big shift because the service forester, his job again is to help that landowner achieve their objectives. Definitely he's centered on fulfilling that landowner's needs. When you switch over, you're in a completely different world. Now you're serving the needs of the forest products company that you work for and helping to supply their resources. Now, that's why I say, you know, those are kind of, they're similar objectives, but they're different also. Do you know what I mean? So I think it helps me balance it because I still, to this day, I've always loved that aspect of service forester's job. I've always said it's, you know, as far as an enjoyable job, working with landowners and helping them achieve their objectives is very self-satisfying. So I've always kept that and it's in my nature. So even though my main objective now is to supply wood fiber to Pixels Spring Grove facility, I still, that landowner's objectives and making sure that landowner's happy, not that that's not every procurement forester's objective, but I mean, I think I really have a strong sense and you know, a strong desire to make sure that landowner is happy and satisfied when we complete their project. So I think the service and that part of my career, I think, helped me a lot in that aspect of this job.
Yeah, and that's interesting because it reminds me of customer service, and that is because you are working for landowners who own acres and acres of trees, and they all have different. My work in Washington Farm Forestry and the tree farm program taught me that there are different stands in, they all have different succession rates, and it depends on the landowner's goals, and they can do a lot of testing as well. So for us in the Pacific Northwest, of course, you know, we have elk and deer browsing. And so I've seen up and down the I-5 corridor several different test plots to see how to mitigate that.
Yeah, it's like I said, it's been an interesting career, but anyway, yeah, now, again, I work for Pixel Specialty Solutions now, and it's a large specialty papers manufacturer headquartered out of Spring Grove, Pennsylvania. We actually have four paper mills, one in Spring Grove, one in Jay, Maine, one in Chillicothe, Ohio, and one in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. So it's a fairly large company. Yeah, because if somebody's interested, I'm not going to go into everything about Pixel, but if somebody's interested, we have a really great website. It's just go to Pixel, Pixelle.com, and learn everything you want to know about our forestry operations, specialty papers manufacturing. They have a really neat virtual mill tour on there that I think anybody would find interesting. So it's a really good website if you're interested, not just in Pixel, but in paper manufacturing industry. So been working here, started as Gladfelter. Pixel actually is an evolution of Gladfelter. Gladfelter is a paper company that we were actually their specialty papers division. We were spun off several years ago, purchased by Lindsay Goldberg out of New York, and reborn as Pixel Specialty Solutions. So we've actually, even though the company's fairly new, Gladfelter's been in the paper business since the 1860s. And like I said, a really well-diversified, well-run company, always has been. Very concerned, you know, we're actually third-party certified. We have four certifications from Forest Stewardship Council, Sustainable Forestry Initiative, and the Program for the Endorsement of Forest Certification. So, you know, that demonstrates, I mean, we're committed to sustainability, and we're certified for chain of custody. So that means we care about where the wood comes from that supplies our mills, and we're willing to stand by that. That's what that certification means. We're willing, you know, we're more than willing to let people come and see how we're sourcing our wood fiber.
Yeah, and that's really important today, especially, and with everything going on, and you can point to that, and it's already been done. The forest management chain of custody is really important, and it's actually a lengthy process, and having people help you with that and make sure that that stays in recertification and making sure that you have it kept up to date is always really important. And it's really interesting for me because I got to go to Germany, and I lived in Germany for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So the PEFC that you mentioned is actually something I didn't know very much of in the United right. States, but I also hadn't lived on the East Coast until just now. This year I landed on the East Coast, and I'm living in North Carolina.
Okay.
So yeah, the PEFC, seeing that in Pixel is really exciting. And also Sustainable Forestry Initiative. And the fact that you have all three means that you're triple committed.
That's exactly. And one thing that makes, you know, actually makes our job a little tougher in areas like this, you know, we don't buy any conversion wood, and we've pretty much stuck to that. And I'll tell you, that makes my job tough sometimes.
Yeah.
because, you know, I'm in an area where we can talk about that a little bit if you want, but there's a lot of development pressure in this area on the Delmarva Peninsula because we're close to the ocean. And there is a lot of that conversion wood out there. In the past, we had bought it, but we pretty much made that commitment to not buy any conversion wood. And again, sometimes, you know, I kind of grit my teeth on that. We could buy a little, but yeah, the company has stuck to that policy. So again, very, very committed to sustainability.
And that's the same thing that's happening in the foothills of the Cascades of the Pacific Northwest. Mount Rainier specifically, my girlfriend actually has a horse farm in Buckley, Washington, and it butts up against the most beautiful view of Mount Rainier, which, you know, she's 15, almost 14.5, I believe, 14,500 feet. And so they have said that their landlord was teased with $1 million offer, and the landlord turned it down and said, no, I'd rather keep it in the land and in the people who are here, and not turn it over for development. But of course, in that area, who's encroaching is industrial, like Amazon.
Wow.
So it's similar. It's just on a different coast.
Yeah. And, you know, going off the forest products end of it, one of the things I do in what little spare time I have, and I don't devote enough time to it, but I'm on the board of a local land trust here, the Lower Shore Land Trust, which I tell you, land trusts are a really important tool, like the landowner you were talking about, to help people in that situation who do want to make sure that their land is protected in the future. Land trusts have been a fantastic tool to help people achieve that objective.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been a land steward myself on the Nisqually River in Washington State, and I was tasked with being basically a monitor of the land, and I learned how to do it. It's fun because they did a program where they trained you for 40 hours, and then you were to give them 40 of your volunteer hours back for training you, and right. It was in what I also liked about it was that it was in conjunction with the Nisqually people, and they're the First Nation of the land. And so we got to go see some of their equipment and see, you know, things that they've invested in to keep their land, such as a fish weir in the middle of the river. And we got to see those kinds of things. And so you're right. I think it's really important. And those are going to keep that conversion from happening.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, I've known people, you know, way in the past who actually had to sell off property to retain other parts of it just due to, you know, tax situations and whatever, estate stuff. And yeah, land trust can help people hang on to their land. And as I said, some people, you know, are worried about what's going to happen after they've gone. Well, that will give them that assurance that it's going to be protected in perpetuity. So again, a great, great tool to help against these conversions and parcelization of properties, which, you know, that to me is always has been and really still is the greatest danger to forestry, especially in areas that are seeing a lot of this urban pressure is just parcelization and conversion. But even parcel, I always see parcelization as the biggest danger.
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, you can do forest surveys, and if somebody takes a 200-acre parcel, say, and breaks it into, you know, what, 45-acre lots, on a survey, it might still be forest. It might predominantly be forest, but is that available to forest industry? Probably not. So, you know, even though somebody might say, well, you know, 20 acres of the 200 was actually converted, 195 or whatever, you know, is still forest, that's not going to be available for management work, most likely.
And also what happens with that is you run into having to do what's called as what's known as RMZs. And if there is wetland, creek, or anything in Washington State, they have designated 100-foot buffers on any riparian management zone. And so that kind of cutting up and fragmenting the land, like Tony's talking about, you run into then having to manage the land for those plots rather than just managing the 200 acres. and it can those boundaries, well, not only does someone have to go mark those boundaries, but also you have to figure out where they are, and then that parceled section you have to take care of differently than you would just the 200 acres the way it would be in the beginning. And that's definitely something to think about.
Very difficult. And this you know, housing sprawl, you know, invasives, again, another big issue. Hard to tackle. And I see it, you know, there's more and more invasives out there all the time. And a lot of it is a result of this, you know, what do you want to call it? Shotgun development, but it's this actual sprawl, you know, and again, a lot of issues there. So I've always felt, you know, fragmentation is a really big problem. Conversion is too, but conversion's obvious. I mean, we can all see.
Yeah.
But I think fragmentation is a concept that the average person has a harder time understanding the issues.
Yeah. And so what Tony means by we can all see conversion is when you drive down your local road that you knew back in the day, and all of a sudden you're going, it looks completely different. There's buildings I have not seen before. Right, exactly. That is exactly what we mean.
Or you go someplace you haven't been in 25 years, and as you said, it was, you remember like a forested landscape, and it's, you don't even know where you are anymore. Just as you said, it's dramatic, and the longer that you live, the more you see it. But it is, it's, you know, that's something people can relate to that.
Yeah, and that's definitely happened in the foothills of the Cascades. I remember going into even where I started living in Spanaway, it was mostly forest in the 70s and 80s, and now it's urban sprawl. And there's a town called Graham, and that place has all these high-rise apartments, and it used to be just trees. And it's harder for the landowners to keep forests as forests when that is a huge incentive to have, you know, that kind of funding backed almost immediately and faster than the investment of a tree plot. And it takes time, and you have to nurture the land and be a land steward. And so there is, you know, that. But what I have found is that there are tree farm and landowners in that area who are still keeping their land and keeping it in their family, which is really important. Estate planning is really important.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Tony, if you could teach the public something about forestry, what would it be?
I think if I could teach the public anything on forestry, it would be how foresters are environmentalists, and environmentalists are technically foresters. In other words, all people who work in natural resource community and all people who are interested in protecting forests are on the same team. And sometimes I think people don't realize it. I'll tell you something. When I did interpretive programs with kids, one of the questions I would always ask the kids was, is it bad to cut down trees? And of course, you can imagine what the answer always is. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Bad thing to do. So I would ask them, well, is your house a bad thing? Are books a bad thing? You know, is the furniture in your house a bad thing? Well, of course, they didn't think any of those were bad things. And I said, you know, it's not bad to cut down trees, but we have to do it responsibly. We have to plant trees back. We have certain areas that maybe we don't want to cut trees, and other areas that we do want to. So I think I would just say that, because we all run into that too, and you know, especially people working in this field where you kind of feel like maybe some people who you think you're on the same team as maybe see you as the enemy. And of course, in any profession, it's going to be disagreements. We're not going to agree 100% of the time. But foresters, including industrial foresters who are out there in the woods, yeah, we're cutting trees down every day. But we're, you know, I'll put it this way, just as I told you when I started in forestry, I don't know any foresters who went in this profession because they hated the forest and wanted to destroy the forest. That's not what we are in this profession because we love the forest. And we've had that love, you know, since we were young. So there's no foresters who are out there who are trying to damage forest. We're all trying to protect it. Again, we might disagree in, you know, the technicalities and specific objectives in certain cases, or you know, objectives on specific pieces of land. But but we're all looking at the same target there. And that's something I would like the public to understand, because like any profession, we're here to serve the public. You know, we're here to serve society. And if we're doing that, we're going to have a long, long run in the forestry profession. If we're not, people are going to decide that maybe that's not something we should be doing, and we'll go a different direction. But I mean, every profession is the same. If we're not serving society, we're not gonna be here for the long run.
Some of the major things that you've touched on are really important, in that foresters and environmentalists have come together, and actually recently we've been talking about it in sustainable forestry groups online, that the mass timber sector has actually brought us together. Mm-hmm. And it's been really nice to work together with designers, architects, and people who are planning building with wood and using wood. And so that's what's really important. And, you know, Tony talked about going out and logging. And yes, that is part of it. But what happens is each state has laws that make it so we have to work with the loggers and foresters, and we have to work with interdisciplinary teams that manage these forests. And that's what part of Tony's work is working with a team of people on the land and making sure that we're also replacing, and any tree that we harvest, we're replacing trees. And there are more trees now than there were a long time ago, because we have to replant.
Exactly. And no, that's true. I can remember looking at old photographs, showing old photographs to school kids too, of certain areas on the Eastern Shore where back at the turn of the century, there weren't any trees. And now it's all forested, all old abandoned farms from back around the Depression era. And a lot of people are surprised to know that at least in some areas, there's more trees now than there were 100 years ago. So that's definitely true. But what you said too, I'll give Pixel another plug, because the way we do it here, Kendra, you're exactly right. We check the state database. Any potential harvest that we look at, we check the state's database for rare, threatened, and endangered species. And if there's any kind of hits or any, you know, state records there, we always coordinate with the Department of Natural Resources and their heritage people to get recommendations before we do a harvest. That's something, I don't know that everybody does that, but we certainly do it. And that's something that, you know, 20 years ago was, somebody might have done it, but that's not something that was generally done. So we do work together. And as you said, state forest management, the interdisciplinary teams, I mean, they really are. They do a great job here in Maryland. I've worked some with the management team on Chesapeake State Forest down here. And that is, interdisciplinary team does a great job. And again, a lot of debates, a lot of disagreements, but I mean, you know, they're all working towards a common goal, and they do a really good job of it. So it is definitely, forestry has evolved over the years.
Okay. Yeah, definitely. And there are more diverse positions now than there used to be. It's not just your guy going out and cruising timber and, you know, sitting on the land and talking to the loggers and getting the loggers down, getting the payload down, and, you know, getting that log down into the mill. It's not about that anymore. It's definitely more driven with how we can utilize the land and be more sustainable. And that's what Pixel does.
That's right. I mean, even things like, let's face it, climate change. When I was in school back in the early 80s, we didn't talk about anything like that. You know, carbon sequestration. I mean, these are all, as I said, you know, every profession, again, has to continue to evolve.
Yeah.
And we are doing that.
Yeah.
And so like you said, or like we were saying, that's something, you know, that sometimes with the public at large, I hope that they're seeing that.
Yeah, we are trying and definitely utilizing that, that team in the West. We have ecologists that are amazing, and geologists that work with the Cascade Range because of Mount St. Helens. And I've actually, in school, what they do now is they do field trips where you get to meet all those people. So even though you go to forest management school, that may not be your track when you get out. You can go do anything else. And it's more of a nature sector now and more of a natural resource, I think is probably the best word. But we still use forestry because we're still old school in our terminology, but definitely more diverse in different sectors of the forest.
Talking Forests is happy to have hashtag Forest Proud as an in-kind sponsor of the Talking Forest podcasts. What is Forest Proud? We are a community committed to making choices that keep forests as forests. We work at family businesses, forest product companies, conservation, recreation organizations, universities, and government agencies. And many of us have done so for generations. We are hikers, hunters, bikers, landowners, loggers, truck drivers, architects, researchers, foresters, students who work in and care about and share a passion for forests and forest products. The hashtag Forest Proud community is bigger than you might think. What does Forest Proud mean? It's a good question. Forest Proud means different things for different people, and that's a good thing. We all have a part to play in making choices that keep our forests as forests and help make our neighborhoods, communities, and lives better. If you live, work, or play in the forests or with forest products, you're a part of the Forest Proud community. ForestProud.org welcomes you.
It's about time to wrap up, and just one more question. Mm-hmm. What does Forest Proud mean to you personally?
I would say, you know, having been in the profession for 40 years, I've seen a lot of changes, and I think I would just say Forest Proud is just proud of all the natural resource managers that have come along and I've worked with and I've seen go. But I think we've done a really, really good job over the last 40 years. Not perfect, but when I look back, like at places where I planted trees back in the early 80s, and those are pretty stands of pine now, or areas where we did some timber stand improvement or some wildlife work that are, you know, beautiful areas of oak now, that gives me a lot of pride. And again, just as you said, not just foresters, but wildlife biologists I've worked with, soil conservationists, water resource people, just a lot of different people, different disciplines that have come together and are constantly striving to improve on how we do things and improve the profession and just improve the force for society, for everybody, because we all benefit clean air, clean water. Let's face it, even people who don't realize it, we're all benefiting from healthy forests.
Yeah, definitely. And there are tree landowners out there who are making that clean water for the public, and that is something that's another thing to talk about later, but the incentivization of owning a plot of trees, and that what you provide to the public, and that is definitely clean water. You're providing climates for all of those critters that are being pushed out from urban development, and definitely different for, I know for a fact that different stages of forest are meant for the deer and the squirrels and the bugs, the fungi. And that was all, you know, stuff that I learned in college. Mm-hmm. And then just being able to work with each person in that team is really, really important. And we all come together and create a great, healthy forest. And so I wanted to thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And definitely we'll have this coming out sometime next week. So I'm super excited. Tony, you've been a great guest. And it's just exciting to hear more about Maryland's forestry. And thank you for being a face of forestry.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it. Thank you, Ken.